Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. For railroad buffs, there's nothing better than reminiscing about 1946. Historian Richard C. Carpenter says it was the year when the impressive system of American railroads was at a peak, as it was about to face the challenges of highway and airline competition in the post-war era. Iowa was awash in rail lines. Practically every town had passenger service. There were 12 Class I railroads operating in Iowa. Carpenter is busy compiling a series of atlases of the rail system in the U.S. in 1946, and his newly released fifth volume of A Railroad Atlas of the United States in 1946 is now out, covering the states of Iowa and Minnesota. Mr. Carpenter, thanks so very much for taking some time to talk to me today. It's really nice to have you on Talk of Iowa.
It's a pleasure.
You write in your Railroad Atlas, and this is Volume 5?
Yes, 5.
Covering Minnesota and Iowa, that in 1920, Iowa, with 9,808 miles of railroad line, was fourth after Texas, Illinois, and Pennsylvania in total route miles of railroad lines. So Iowa was very densely covered in rail lines for a long time. Now, why was that?
Well, I can only assume they had to bring the harvest in, agriculture probably, and then in the cities you had industries, manufacturing. And, of course, the other factor for Iowa was it was on the path of the Transcontinental Railroad, and Abraham Lincoln in 1862 designated Council Bluffs as the beginning of the Union, what would become the Union Pacific Transcontinental Railroad. And so that meant that a number of other railroads built lines headed for Council Bluffs or connected to Council Bluffs, the Chicago Great Western, the Illinois Central, the Chicago and Northwestern, the Milwaukee Road, the Chicago, Rock Island and Pacific, and the Chicago, Burlington and Quincy.
You say in your atlas that 12 Class I railroads were operating in Iowa in 1946. Of course, this series of books is focusing on 1946, with a total of 8,515 route miles. It's so much fun to look at the atlas and look at these old rail lines and their names. Here's the Class I railroads operating in Iowa, as you write, in 1946, the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe. Of course, that song is now in my head.
Yep.
The Chicago
sure.
and Northwestern, the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy, the Chicago Great Western, the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific, also known as the Milwaukee Road, the Chicago, yep. Rock Island, and Pacific, the Chicago, St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Omaha, what was called the Omaha Road, the Great Northern, the Illinois Central, the Minneapolis and St. Louis, the Union Pacific, which had just 2 miles of rail, and the Wabash. It's great names, great railroad lines, aren't they?
Yes, they're fallen flags, most of them. They don't exist anymore as companies.
Well, what happened was mergers after 1946. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. I wanted to ask you why you chose 1946 for this series of atlases on the railroads in the U.S.
So in the text, and it was because it was right at the end, right after the end of World War II, near the end of a long period without any mergers at all. There were a few mergers in the 20s, but there were nothing like the mergers that took place after the, mainly in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so a period of stability in portraying the railroads for 1946, you were in effect portraying what the situation had been for the previous, say, 30 or 40 years.
Why was there so much stability from 1910 or so to 1946?
Well, you didn't have the interstate highway system. In the 20s and 30s, particularly in the 30s, you really began to see highway competition, truck competition, and bus and automobile compete with the railroads. But you had to wait until, in the latter part of the 50s for the interstate highway network to begin to really be built and to take a big part of what had been intercity rail freight and passenger.
Well, let's go back to 1946, and we'll focus on Iowa, because Iowa now included in Volume 5 of your wonderful series the Railroad Atlas of the United States in 1946. Let's go back to 1946. What was it like living in a medium-sized Iowa town or city, let's say Ames, for example? There were more railroad lines close to where you were at that time, more passenger lines, more freight trains passing through. What was it like back then?
Well, you were never very far from a railroad line in Iowa. There was very little inhibition to people building rail lines, and they tended to build them in sort of a geometric pattern that not just north and south, but east and west, and then northeast and southwest, you know, angles. So it in part was dictated by where the main line tended to go, and then along that main line, you would build branch lines to or feeder lines to pick up and deliver goods to small communities not on the main line.
You write that nearly every town of any size had its own freight agent, coal unloading trestle, and bulk delivery track.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That was a standard sort of layout at a station of any size. You had to have some place to leave a car so it could be either loaded or unloaded, and it had to be some kind of siding because obviously you had to make room for trains passing through and trains meeting other trains at stations, holding a siding while a second train went through.
And you said that almost every town had a passenger train moving through at some point, right?
Yes.
Because we certainly don't see that today. It's very rare.
You really just have one line, as far as I know, that carries passenger service, and that's Amtrak running over the Burlington.
And back in 46, there would have been ways to get to Minneapolis, to get to Omaha, to get to Chicago, to get to St. Louis, and from there.
The Chicago Great Western is an interesting example. It came out of Chicago and went to Owine, Iowa, which still has rail service, mainly because there was a large repair shop there. And then one line turns north to St. Paul in Minneapolis. Another line goes west to Council Bluffs. And a third line goes southwest to Kansas City. Another interesting railroad is the Minneapolis and St. Louis, which ran from St. Paul through Minneapolis down to Mason City and then over, out coming out the southeast side of the state and running all the way to Peoria, Illinois, where it interchanged with a number of other eastern and southern railroads.
So there were a lot of people hopping on their local railroad in their towns and cities and going to any place in the United States.
Yes, that was the transportation network was the American Railroad Network for a long period of time. So from before the Civil War right up into the post-war period after World War II. And, of course, it's interesting to note that there's more freight, ton miles of freight being moved on American railroads today than there ever was before.
Is that right?
Yeah, this is something I discovered, and it's obviously moving on fewer miles of track, but there are more freight trains going by key points. To give you an example, the Santa Fe that runs down through Fort Madison, Iowa, which is a crew change point and a shop, there's probably just a continuous stream of trains. As soon as one train goes by, you don't have to wait very long before you see the next. And it's on something that the Burlington Northern calls, Santa Fe calls, a transcon between Chicago and Los Angeles.
When I was a kid, my parents and I would take the Illinois Central from Waterloo, Iowa, into Chicago. And, of course, that's another case of a rail line, a company that's totally been out of business for a long time. It was a great...
Well, it's still there. I think there are parts of the IC, not as the IC, but many of those lines... Some of those lines are still there, and they're operated by different railroads, different names.
I see. Mr. Carpenter, I just was amazed by the beauty of your various maps. You have in each volume a couple hundred pages of plates of counties and cities, and the rail lines are in color. And you did all of this by hand, didn't you?
That's correct. Yeah, I love to draw maps. There's probably over 1,000 maps in the five volumes.
Where did you get your information from to compile all this?
Railroad employee timetables, railroad atlases, railroad track charts, A large part of this information is available on the Internet. You can look up these things at various websites on the Internet. I'm still amazed at how much information I was able to get. And there's a wonderful resource called MapTech, which enables you to look at any United States Geological Survey topographic map in the United States. And just look at it, and you can copy a section of it. And I found them very useful for making detail maps, and because many of those maps were made back in the 1950s and 60s and only recently revised, it was a resource that was very appropriate for a 1946 atlas. Mm.
You write that more than 1.3 million railroad workers were needed in 1946 to manage this complex transportation delivery system. In addition to, and I'm quoting your introduction, in addition to five-person train crews, and you say often with a sixth or swing crewman added in some states.
So they have to go over a heavy grade or have to, originally the brakemen had to go out on the tops of the cars and turn brake handles to apply the brakes on a train. A lot of very dangerous and hard work. And that, of course, hasn't been done for years. The brakes are applied from the engine, the locomotive, by the engineer, but that's why you required that extra crewman.
They didn't go up on the...
only two people in the crew.
There's
the
just
conductor
two.
Conductor and the engineman.
Just two for even a very long freight train?
That's correct.
And no cabooses anymore?
Well, sometimes you see them on industrial switching lines in cities, but out on the main line, they're the only thing you see at the rear end of a train is an end-of-train device, which is a flashing light fastened to the rear coupler.
These men didn't get on top of the cars when they were moving, did they?
Oh, yes, they did.
Oh, my gosh.
And sometimes they fell off, too, because it could be very icy up there in the wintertime. Very dangerous work.
And you say there were station agents, signal tower operators, and signal maintainers, ticket collectors, track mm-hmm. laborers, roadhouse and shop workers, yard clerks, and train masters. What a busy, complex system back then. It must have been just amazing to see it all work.
Yes, lots of people working along the line, not just in the stations, section gang people repairing track and signal maintainers and other construction workers.
And you say we no longer hear the old clickety-clack sound when trains head down the track. It's gone because of a way they make the rails these days?
Yeah, they have welded rail. The rails are welded together so that you have a mile or a quarter mile or half a mile with no gap in the rail track. They have to have a gap every once in a while to take up expansion and contraction. But that's continuous welded rail is the reason you don't have the clickety-clack.
Mm. And you say many types of buildings in all of these towns and villages, stations, signal towers, freight houses, water tanks, section houses, tool sheds, most of them wooden, stood along the railroad tracks. Do you see any of these structures still around?
Oh, a few of them. Most of the signal towers have been torn down. The last signal tower in Iowa was at Iowa City, and it was called Mills Tower, M-I-L-L-S, and it was operated by the Illinois Central Railroad. Oh, it was Iowa Falls. I'm sorry, wrong place. Iowa Falls, last manned signal tower in Iowa. And in a few places around the country, they have been saved as museums. Orville, Ohio, Grafton, Ohio, Kingston, Rhode Island, South Norwalk, Connecticut, right here in my hometown. Mm. And I have served as a tour guide there at a restored signal tower with a 68 lever mechanical interlocking.
And so there's an actual person up there doing all of these.
People were up there working. Not anymore. Very few towers still exist in the United States. There's one in Detroit called Del Rey. Uh-huh. And here and there, you very, very rarely do you find an operating signal tower. Another one is at Fostoria, Ohio.
Mr. Carpenter, you say that in 1946, nearly everyone watched passenger trains. And even more fun, I suppose, were the freight trains with more variety, different sorts of cars.
Sure, colorful cars.
You still have a lot of people out there watching trains, I think, don't you?
Oh, sure, sure. We don't have very many freight trains at all running through South Norwalk, I'm sorry to say. We could use some of that, because we have so many trucks on Interstate 95. But most of the trains running through Norwalk, almost all of them are passenger trains.
Well, we have a freight train that moves just about half a block from the Iowa Public Radio studio here in Iowa City that messes up traffic at least three or four times a day.
Oh, okay.
How have things changed on passenger trains today versus in the 1946? What was it like taking a passenger train?
Well, in 1946, you had a very, very big investment in the Pullman, by the Pullman Company, in mm-hmm. Pullman cars. Even a few trains were all Pullman cars with no coaches. You do have first-class service on Amtrak now, but there's no more Pullman service. So there's that difference. And of course, we know that there were passenger trains running everywhere, and many of them included dining cars and lounge cars along the main heavily traveled routes. So the difference is, of course, that there's been a great diminishment in the number of passenger trains. The Amtrak network, which I'm happy to say still flourishes and seems to be doing very well, is just a shadow of what once was in terms of the national passenger rail freight network.
Are you optimistic about the future of railroads?
Oh, certainly am. I think the freight railroads are doing very well. And as the cost of energy goes up, the attractiveness of using rail to move freight long distances is very high. And you find what I've heard, most of the Amtrak lines seem to be steadily increasing in patronage.
Well, that's good. That's good to know. Mr. Carpenter, it's been really fun to talk to you, and it's really great to read your Volume 5, the Railroad Atlas of the United States in 1946, Volume 5, including Iowa and the state of Minnesota. So thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Richard C. Carpenter is the author of the newly released Volume 5 of A Railroad Atlas of the United States in 1946, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Talk of Iowa's executive producer is Catherine Perkins. For Charity Nebbe, I'm Dennis Reese.
On the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
All aboard, she's on her way.
See the old smoke rising round the bend. I reckon that she knows she's gonna meet a friend. Folks around these parts get the time of day. From the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
Here she comes.